Few poets these days write in rhyme and meter. Vikram Seth not only writes poems that rhyme, but he wrote his novel, The Golden Gate, in metered verse. The 1986 novel was a love story set in contemporary San Francisco. Seth wrote it while in graduate school in California. Seth was born in Calcutta and spent most of his youth in India. He studied in England before coming to the U.S. His new collection of poems, All You Who Sleep Tonight, is written in rhyme. I asked him why he writes in a style that most contemporary poets have abandoned.
I suppose when I was very young, the idea that poetry didn't rhyme would have come to me as a bit of a shock. You know, my nursery rhymes, well, being nursery rhymes, they were in rhyme. And most of the poetry that we are brought up on in India is fairly conventional poetry. Lots of Wordsworth, lots of Tennyson, that sort of stuff. So I was rather startled when, in fact, I started reading some modern poetry or poetry written in this century, which didn't rhyme. And then I was even more startled when I found out that those who did try to rhyme their poetry were sort of considered passé or reactionary in some sense. So with desperate eagerness, I started lopping off all the rhymes in my poems and started writing in unrhymed and unmetered forms. And it took me a little while before I came around to the recognition that I shouldn't constrain myself. That is, if a poem came out in free verse, well and good. And if, in fact, it struck me that it was best suited to rhyme and meter, then that's what I should do. In other words, I should just let the poem breathe the way that it wanted to.
Let me ask you to read one of the poems that's collected in your new volume. And this poem is called Sure. Soon. You can introduce it for us if you'd like.
All right. Perhaps I'll say a few words after I've read the poem, so as not to kind of precondition anyone. I shall die soon, I know. This thing is in my blood. It will not let me go. It saps my cells for food. It soaks my nights in sweat and breaks my days in pain. No hand or drug can treat these limbs for love or gain. Love was the strange first cause that bred grief in its seed, and gain knew its own laws to fix its place and breed. He whom I love, thank God, won't speak of hope or cure. It would not do me good. He sees that I am sure. He knows what I have read and will not bring me lies. He sees that I am dead. I read it in his eyes. How am I to go on? How will I bear this taste? My throat cased in white spawn, these hands that shake and waste. Stay by my steel ward bed and hold me where I lie. Love me when I am dead and do not let me die. Well, there are two things about the poem. The first thing is the obvious one, I suppose, that it's about AIDS and someone who's dying of it, and this poem is written in the voice of someone who's affected by the disease. The second thing, and this has really nothing to do with the power of the poem, but it might be just of interest, is that every word in that poem is exactly one syllable long. And the reason I didn't want to say either of those two things before I read the poem was that poems need to sort of reveal their own subjects as they're read. And secondly, this sort of stylistic aspect of it, for instance, the fact that every word is one syllable long, that could become obtrusive to the listener if they were conscious of it beforehand.
Well, I'll confess that I've read that poem several times and I didn't notice that all the words were one syllable long.
I'm very glad of that.
Oh, you're glad of that, huh?
Well, I'm glad of that because I feel that, you know, if one has... I don't think art or form should bludgeon the reader or the listener. If it works, it should work quietly.
Well, what interested you in that form?
I just found the poem coming out like that. And I suppose, though this isn't something that I would lay too much weight on, that the breathlessness that maybe is associated with the subject of the poem, the difficulty of speech and of any kind of expenditure of energy might perhaps have some relation to it.
What kind of structures have you been working with, or have you worked with in your rhyming metered poems?
Well, the one that perhaps has influenced me the most, in that I wrote a whole book of, I guess, 300 pages in it, is what's known as the Pushkin stanza. And that's a stanza that was formed and immortalized by Alexander Pushkin, the great Russian poet and novelist. It's a 14-line stanza, rather like a sonnet, except that instead of having 5 feet like the standard Shakespearean sonnet, it has four. So it goes sort of ta-dum, 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 ta-dum. I'd like to read this poem out. Or I hear your name is Terry Gross, or something like that. So it's got a four-beat line. And it's got an elaborate rhyming pattern. But again, what pleased me about this meter, especially when I was reading Pushkin's Eugene Onegin, was that he can write about the most flippant things in this meter, and they take off. And then he can write about things that just have you in tears. And it's the same form. It's the same strict form.
Do you find it difficult to read metered rhyming verse and not have it sound really sing-song?
Has this got something to do with what I did just now?
Well, no, but even when you're it's like ta-tum, 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 ta-tum.
That's actually the sort of pedagogic explanation.
Yeah, I was just emphasizing it.
But for instance, if I were reading, say, a stanza of, say the Golden Gate, I would certainly not read it in that way. For instance, in a passage, John is complaining to Jan. He says, "I'm young, employed, healthy, ambitious, sound, solvent, self-made, self-possessed, but all my symptoms are pernicious. The Dow Jones of my heart's depressed. The sunflower of my youth is wilting. The tower of my dreams is tilting. The zoom lens of my zest is blurred. The drama of my life's absurd. What is the root of my neurosis? I jog, eat brewer's yeast each day, and yet I feel life slip away. I wait your sapient diagnosis. I die, I faint, I fail, I sink. You need a lover, John, I think." It doesn't have to be read, you know. It should be read any you know, lively way.
You've studied in England, America, and China. Have you found there to be really different teaching styles in each country?
I would say that one thing that struck me when I went from England, where I'd been an undergraduate, to America, where I was a graduate student, was this. There's a great amount of freedom given in England for people to sort of follow their own inclination, their own bent, their own interests. When I went to America as a graduate student, I found, oddly enough, I felt as if I was reverting to high school. There were lots of tests all the time, which is quite foreign to the English method of education. And there was a sense that you were continually striving for grades. Now, I don't think that was a very good idea, certainly with respect to certain subjects. It might work for certain scientific subjects, but not, I think, for literature, history, or even the subject that was my subject, economics.
Why did you study economics?
I got into university in England through the literature exams that they have. But there were, in those days, about 9 months between admission to university, at least that university, and entrance. So I wandered home, and I thought a little about things, and I realized I'd never really lose my taste for literature. Why was I going to spend 4 years studying it, especially since much of the curriculum would be reading criticism or reading books which I might have preferred to read more at leisure or at some other time in my life? Then I thought to myself, well, supposing I'm not going to study literature, what will I study? And I realized that economics would be an interesting subject, partly because I thought it might help me to understand the way the world worked, partly because my father, you know, works in business, and maybe it would help me understand the way his mind worked. And partly because I thought maybe it would help, you know, help mm-hmm. back home in India.
After living so many years in other countries, you've returned to India. What brought you back there?
Partly, I suppose, the fact that that I could afford to go back. And the second thing was, I suppose, I'd always told myself I'd go back. I wanted to be with the family, my folks, are not, you know, very young. And I also wanted to write a novel set in India. But the fact was that although I thought that my degree in California would only stretch out for 4 years, I found year following year, and by the end of it was about 11 years. So I decided, okay, I'm getting out now. Book's been published. I can afford to get out. If I don't get out now, I don't know when I will. I was enjoying California so much, I could have stayed there forever.
Let me ask you to read one more poem. Would you read Round and Round for us? It's the first poem in your new collection.
Right. Round and Round. After a long and wretched flight that stretched from daylight into night, where babies wept and tempers shattered, and the plane lurched and whiskey splattered over my plastic food, I came to claim my bags from baggage claim. Around, the carousel went around. The anxious travelers sought and found their bags, intact or gently battered, but to my foolish eyes what mattered was a brave suitcase, red and small, that circled round, not mine at all. I knew that bag. It must be hers. We hadn't met in 7 years. And as the steel plates squealed and clattered, my happy memories chimed and chattered, an old man pulled it off the claim. My bags appeared. I did the same.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Sure, Terry. Thank you.
Vikram Seth's new volume of poems, All You Who Sleep Tonight, is published by Knopf.